Just remind me.
Did she get the OneNote stuff sorted?
Yeah, she did. Oh, thank you. Huge life changing.
Make such an amazing.
Okay, want to open this? What are we? February 10th, 2011 meeting of the Higher Education Subcommittee of the House Education Committee. I'd like to call it to order. Today on the agenda, we are continuing with our Higher Ed 101 for this committee. On Tuesday, we had the universities, and today we are moving to workforce development and community colleges. And we are going to follow that with a public hearing on one of our bills, which has to do with a subject that really marries those two entities, and that's the career readiness certificate. So, first of all, I'd like to open this informational meeting on higher education in Oregon and call up the Honorable Representative John Huffman and the also Honorable Greg White. And they're going to talk to us about the Oregon Workforce Investment Board.
I want to thank you for having us today and giving us the opportunity to talk about OWIB, Oregon Workforce Investment Board. I'm John Huffman, state rep for District 59, which is a big chunk of eastern Oregon. But I'm also one of the members of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. Speaker Merkley appointed me to that board several years ago, and I thoroughly enjoyed it and done a lot of work within the building and outside of the building on workforce development, and learned a long time ago that education and workforce are literally inseparable. We have to work on them together, and I think we've learned that probably the last couple of years in a stronger way than we would have cared to, and there's a lot of work going on in the building. Thankfully, in your committee, the Education Committee, Business and Labor, to try to make sure that we're skilling people up and getting them degreed and at all levels of development. One of the fun things, I was just telling one of the freshmen yesterday, had a conversation, and I said, you know, if you hang in here long enough, you really start to see some of your ideas. You know, you keep banging that drum and you eventually start seeing some of your ideas develop. And part of my work on the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, a few years back, we were kind of entering the recession, and one of our members on the board has been Lori Warner, the director of the Employment Department. And I've thoroughly enjoyed working with Lori. And one of the things I have been able to do, having eight kids, I look at them as eight guinea pigs. And so at some point in their life or in the recession or whatever the case might be, I am, and John, is John still sitting behind me? Because we had this conversation just the other day, and I was talking to him about my guinea pig, Sarah, and we're working on a project there. But anyway, Lori was sitting in an OWIB meeting one day talking about the process that an unemployed person would go through as they go into to the employment department, their local office, and sign up for benefits. And so I thought, I'm curious. I'm just going to check that out. Not that I don't trust Lori. She's been a great help and helped get a bill through the 09 session that really helped unemployed workers and businesses at the same time. It was called the WorkShare program. But anyway, I went out, and my oldest son, Mark, was chronically unemployed at the time. And so I said, hey, Mark, I want you to just kind of relate back what your experiences are as you go into the unemployment process. Well, his experience didn't match what Lori had described at all. So I went back to Lori and I said, we may have a disconnect here. You know, we started working on a plan, and much like I do with my annual tease, if you will, on the 40-40-20 and getting people degreed up and in relationship to private career colleges, I kind of do the same thing with a handful of topics. And I said, why in the world aren't we taking advantage of this opportunity to assess people when they come in for unemployment, particularly if they were displaced from a $9 an hour job. Can't we do an assessment? Can't we require an assessment to get benefits? I don't know what the law is, but can't we do some of this stuff? And then after getting them assessed, maybe guide them into other skilling up things that they might be able to do so that when they do find a job, they can go into an $11 an hour job. And if they're unemployed at $11 an hour, let's do the same thing and get them into a $13 an hour job. And so it stuck after a while, and in January we had our OWIB meeting, and somebody from the Employment Department was making a presentation about the process now that an unemployed individual goes through when they enter the office. And he was lining out the stuff that we had been talking about over the last few years. And so it makes you feel good when you sit on these boards, commissions, task forces long enough and say the same thing. You know, change does occur for the good ideas, and I think that was a good one. Another big thing that we worked on for skilling up and employment and education in general was the National Career Readiness Certificate, and Co-Chair Dembro and I and those of us that have worked on the old House Workforce Development Committee, that was one, if not the only thing that we got out of the last session. But it was a biggie, and I'm proud of it. And Greg White is here to kind of take us into the NCRC and how it is developing. It is now launched statewide, and also some of the other work that OWIB has been doing in connection with Ed and Higher Ed. So thanks for having us, and I'm going to go meet with the speaker now. And good to see everybody.
Okay, before you run, John, committee members, any of you have a question of Representative Huffman? This is your chance.
Thought I was going to sneak in. I'm safe.
Thanks.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks a lot, John.
Very much, Representative Huffman.
Okay, Greg.
Yes, co-chairs Dembro and Johnson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Greg White. I'm executive staff to the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. I really appreciate the opportunity to come in front of you today. Oftentimes, the whole idea of workforce development gets to be a little amorphous with all of the details around the federal programs and some of the other minutiae that accompany these programs. But I do have to say that the intersection between education and the economy and the skills of the workforce and the economy is something that's very real and very important to our state. And so that is one of the main reasons I'm really gratified that you asked me to be here today, because there is a growing recognition of that fact, and I think that that's very important for our economic growth. Just for those of you who don't know, the Oregon Workforce Investment Board is a 24-member business majority advisory board to the governor on workforce matters. The OWIB is driven by leaders representing the private sector, state and local governments, labor, government agencies, so there's a wide spectrum of views and viewpoints on there, but the majority is the employers on the board, and it's really a business-led, business-driven board. The vision of the Oregon Workforce Investment Board is that Oregon employers have a competitive advantage in the global marketplace due to their highly skilled, innovative workers. This is the vision that was developed through our strategic planning process 5 years ago. It's a five-year plan called Winning in the Global Market. We are now in the process of updating that plan and in a two-stage process to see what we learned from the current plan and what needs to be changed going forward. That plan, we have it's been my job and my privilege to actually work the plan over the last 5 years, and I can say that we have made quite a bit of progress. Of course, we had a recession in the middle of it, which of course slows down any kind of progress like that, but nevertheless, the points that we're talking about and that are in the plan still remain valid. And the three goals of the plan are to identify and meet the needs of Oregon businesses for skilled workers, to provide the students and workers with the skills employers demand, and then continue to build an efficient and effective system to do the above. And so you can see that we are talking about the importance of a skilled workforce to economic competitiveness of the state and its businesses. There an overlay to that strategic plan are the four focus areas that we have been working on. They were Governor Kulongoski's four focus areas, and they have been guiding our investments over the last at least 4 years. Those four focus areas are healthcare, manufacturing, green jobs, and high-skill, high-demand jobs statewide. And most of our focus has been on those. Of course, healthcare is everywhere in the state, but some of the others aren't. Therefore, the whole focus has been on this high-skill, high-demand job, and to the extent possible, high-wage job. There's also a connection to Governor Kitzhaber's published jobs and economy agenda, which is to create immediate jobs. Some of the pieces there are energy-efficient schools, the on-the-job training program connected with the National Career Readiness Certificate, biomass development, some access to capital agendas or ideas, to build a stronger base for Oregon's economic growth. This is really a sector approach, which puts us in workforce development terms, in a leadership position in the whole United States. Sector approaches are what we call in the workforce business an aggregation of demand, so that you call an entire industry together and find out what their workforce needs are and other needs and try to meet them. And then to reform the way Oregon does business is the final plank in Governor Kitzhaber's plan. And this is following the Oregon business plan with health care costs, clean energy, public finance, and such. The intersection of workforce and the economy is extremely important. The state's economy, or in fact, in some ways, the world's economy, is based on, at least in part, on the skills of the workforce. In the global economy, businesses can locate anywhere. We can't compete on price. We're not going to compete with a dollar a day in developing countries. We have to compete on our ability to innovate and use higher-level thinking and problem-solving skills. And Oregon is in a competitive race with the world. Economic development is no longer stealing companies from one state to another. We're talking about global competition for these jobs. And so we want to prosper and grow those good jobs here in Oregon. When companies choose to locate in any particular place, whether it be in any state or any location or any country, the skills of the workforce are often a primary concern. That's one of the first things the site selectors ask. What is your workforce like? What are the levels of skills of your workforce? And in today's technology-driven economy, access to the workers with the skills employers need provides us with the competitive edge that we need to be able to prosper. Since you are the Higher Education Subcommittee, I want to talk for a moment about the intersection with higher education. And I do have these kind of prepared remarks or talking points, but I want to get through them quickly so that we can get it to a dialogue if I can in the little time that I have. According to a study called the Skills to Compete Report, nearly 50% of in-demand jobs in Oregon over the next few years will require some post-secondary experience. This doesn't necessarily mean even a two-year degree, but it does mean some post-secondary experience, whether that's an apprenticeship or a certificate or a degree. And according to national sources, as many as 90% of the high-skill jobs are going to require post-secondary education. So we are talking about the necessity to educate our workforce. The skill requirements of the workplace are fast outpacing the skills of the people who are working. When I was, and I'm going to date myself because this is part of the way the economy looked back when I went to school, but when I graduated from North Bend High School on the coast, a lot of my classmates dropped out of school to go work in the mill. And they made a good wage, and as I did in the summer working there. But you can't do that anymore. Now it's a computer-operated workplace. I mean, they know from the computer, from looking at a log, even before it hits the head saw, how many board feet and what dimensions are going to come out of that log. And it's a different kind of workplace. The skill requirements are much greater. That's just one example. We have nearly 200,000 people unemployed in Oregon today, and many of those are our lowest skilled individuals. It's always the ones with the lowest skills who go first, the ones with the highest skills who remain. The unemployment rates for, and I can't give you the exact statistics, are very much lower for educated individuals than for uneducated or low basic skills individuals. So we have a job to do with our current workforce. Because, you know, something like 80% of the workforce that we're going to have in 2020 is working now. So that's where a huge part of our challenge lies. It's not just the kids coming out of high school, although that's incredibly important. But we need to think about working learners in this state. How do we accommodate the needs of working learners? These are people who have jobs or are looking for jobs or are moving from job to job or looking for that better job. And how are we going to help them get the skills to make themselves globally competitive and to make their companies globally competitive? So OWIB is focused on all education levels, but it is you know, from the whole continuum from first grade to 20. But it is very important to think about even beyond that. So I think that's my point. Nationally and in Oregon, it's the community college system that provides the bulk of the training for the workforce system in Oregon. That isn't to say that others don't. There are apprenticeship programs, there are private career schools, all of which play an important part. But the bulk, often in rural areas, it may be that the community college is the only game in town to scale people up. So it's very interesting the kinds of innovations that are happening in community colleges especially, and in the workforce development system and the intersection between the two, that kind of start to meet the needs of the workforce. For example, career pathways. Career pathways, if you don't know, and I'm sure you'll hear about it from my community college compatriots in a moment, is where the curriculum is broken down into manageable pieces that can be certified on the way to an associate degree, and that certification is valued by the employer, so that's a portable certificate that can be taken to the employer and say, I know these skills. Then when the person is ready to move to a better job in that company or somewhere else, they go back to community college and get the next chunk and so forth. It's called laddering, or it's called stackable credentials in many ways, in many places. But this is our Career Pathways program, and Oregon is a leader in this. Accelerated learning opportunities, where this connects college credit while in high school. This is while you're in high school, and this is a boon for parents and kids. I mean, you're free K-12 education you get these as part of your high school education, and you can come out of high school with college credit that gets you a long way down the road. Career technical education is very important. We've disinvested a little in the past years, but I think that some of the things, for EMTs, nurses, and welders, for example, we've worked very hard in those particular occupations to try to get people into these skilled jobs. And then, of course, basic skills and ESL are, of course, extremely important in today's economy and in our changing demographics. And one of the things that we're working on is contextualizing those literacy skills to specific jobs. So a bilingual welding program, for example, or other kinds of examples of programs where people learn English by what they're going to know when they are working, or as they're working. Ideally, it happens at the workplace. As far as Oregon University system, we connect there too. We've connected for specific projects, like helping them out with their professional science master's program. For specific projects, we're very interested in the ETIC investments because it's innovation, as I mentioned before, that drives our economy. And then we've had a focus on green jobs. We just finished in October, coming out of the 2009 session, we had House Bill 3300, which directed the Oregon Workforce Investment Board to develop a green jobs growth plan for the state. And we have done that. It is now published. You can find it on www.worksourceoregon.org under State Workforce Board. It's right up there front and center. It gives an 8-year plan of short and long-term strategies that we can use to grow a green economy in Oregon, which is a high-skill, high-wage economy. And finally, we do have the State Energy Sector Partnership Program, which is also in the green jobs area, where we are training people throughout the state on various green jobs opportunities. It's in a little way. We're waiting for the jobs because of the economy, but we see that it's starting to pick up now. One of the hallmarks of that is the green tech certificate that is being developed in the rural part of our states with the collaboration of 8 community colleges to get folks basic sustainability and green concepts that they can use by an employer who wants to that can be used by an employer who wants to get into this growing part of the economy. Finally, a little bit of realm of speculation that I'd like to leave you with, and this is not any official policy by any means, but it's something to think about, and it's the direction that it's happening throughout the country, and it's a direction that's being pushed by some innovative education thinkers. I just returned from Washington, D.C., where I was part of the National Governors Association meeting, and they were talking about not just numbers of degrees, like we have 40-40-20, but degrees for what jobs. And I think we have to be thinking in that way, because the connection of education and the economy is so incredibly important. Now, we're not going to tell people they can't be philosophy majors by any means, but the truth is that there are very few jobs in that area. We need to start looking at what the demand jobs are or where we would like the state to go and begin to incentivize the kinds of educational programs that get them there. So I'm going to stop there and open it up for questions.
Okay, thank you, Greg. That's very much in keeping with the spirit of Higher Ed 101. You've thrown out all sorts of really interesting programs and processes that are underway, and I'm sure people would like to hear more about specific ones. So I open it up to the committee. Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that you're preparing for green jobs. And I like green, I like sustainability, I like all these terms, but I got to tell you that at my work, we have a sustainability practice group, and we're all running around talking about this industry that I don't see exists. I don't see jobs out there, green jobs. And so my question is, what are the green jobs you're preparing for? I mean, do you teach them how to... I guess explain that a little bit. What is a green job, and how are you preparing for that?
I wish I had brought it with me. I did not. It's been over a year now that the OWIB funded the Employment Department to come up with the Greening of Oregon report, which actually defines what a green job is. And a green job is not necessarily what you might think of. It's not all the solar installer or the wind turbine technician, although those are certainly jobs that exist in Oregon, and quite a few of them. Actually, Oregon has approximately 3% of the jobs are green jobs, according to this definition, which is higher than a percentage than a lot of states. Of course, because we're a small state, the number is maybe lower. But let me give you the example, and if you haven't heard of this before, Lori Luchak is president of Miles Fiberglass, and she is on the Oregon Workforce Investment Board and was co-chair of our Green Jobs Council. The Miles Fiberglass Company, they started by making those housings on top of buildings for air conditioning units, right? But they moved to they branched out to a lot of different kinds of manufacturing opportunities. And in the beginning of the last decade, they were highly into the RV industry. They were making pieces of the bodies of these gigantic RVs that was a big part. These were really a lot of RV manufacturing jobs in Oregon at that time. When the economy turned down and when that industry tanked, they had to look for other opportunities. Well, they had one person on their staff who knew how to repair wind tower blades. You know, these are gigantic things, and they're made of fiberglass. They're made of composites. But they're 200 feet long. You can't take them down and send them to the shop. This is something that has to happen on site, the repair. And they had one person who knew how to do this with a small grant from the Clackamas County Workforce Investment Council. This person was lent to Clackamas Community College, who worked with the educators to design curriculum. And now they have crews out there repairing wind turbine blades in the gorge. And it's not necessarily what you think of when you think green jobs. It's the supply chain. It's the entire supply chain. We had to build the hubs, for example, for those things. They're incredibly technical machining that goes into building those hubs that holds those blades on. Incredibly small tolerances they have to be machined to.
Yeah.
Yes.
And maybe I can just do a follow-up and interrupt you. Sorry there.
Yeah.
And I just want to highlight my concern is anything can be defined as a green job. If whoever manufactures this pen that writes on recycled paper could probably be called a green job.
That is a little hyperbole, but I agree with you.
Correct. I say it a little tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah. Sure.
But my concern is what skills you said that you're training people in green jobs.
Yes.
You're training people to take green jobs. I'm assuming, how do you define this as a green, what green job skill are you teaching?
Well, let me just jump in
because we have a limited amount of time.
I'm sorry.
Greg,
I'd love to take this offline with you, Representative.
Yeah. Sure, let's do that.
Greg, could you send us the Greening of Oregon report?
You bet.
That's online, isn't it?
Yes, it's also on worksourceoregon.org.
Great, and so we can get that out to the committee members. You hear talk about greenwashing in other areas,
right.
And there is a danger of greenwashing in the workforce realm as well. So, point taken.
And I appreciate it. Yeah. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but I would like to continue this conversation. I hope not to be argumentative, but I just want to be careful that we're not greenwashing.
No, I think Representative Lindsay, you have an incredibly valid point, and we do have to, of course, be careful of that. However, right now, any job's a good job, but I'm right there with you.
Yeah. Rep. Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. certainly true. Any job is a good job these days. As my kids got older, they're 25 and 20 now, we talked about career planning, et cetera, and I liked to joke with them and say that when I was, from the time I left high school, I did everything I could to prepare for a job as a software entrepreneur in the research realm, okay, which was, of course, ludicrous given my age, right?
Yes.
And they got it.
Yes.
I think that we should be careful of being overly... I was with you on everything you said, okay, and I commend you and your groups for all of these efforts. I think we need to be cautious about being overly prescriptive of any of these things. We should make available training, and we should not try to pick winners, okay, at this business that I'm very involved in. Software, some of them are CS people, computer science people, some of them are artists, some of them are philosophers from
Absolutely.
Reed College, okay? We need them all.
So I totally agree with that.
Okay.
I think that there is a basic foundational educational set of educational proficiencies that cuts across and prepares those for the jobs that's what we're doing. We're preparing people for jobs that we don't even know what they are yet. You're absolutely right.
And one of the guys at the company who is extremely bright and technical finished high school.
Good.
Never went any further. Couldn't run it without him.
Yeah.
Okay, Rip Johnson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just to segue into, I think, a response back to Representative Lindsay's question, but you did mention in your comments that you made reference to OEB creating jobs and so forth, but I don't think you meant to say that. It heard it that way, but obviously you provide the workforce for the private sector that creates those jobs, and that's the dynamic that we need to keep in mind here. We're providing training for those workers that will be absorbed by and utilized by the private sector, by the guy that has that idea for that new widget or whatever, and he needs workers that are equipped to manufacture widgets. But to get back to Representative Lindsay's question, an example of what I think you're referring to in green job creation or training is what happens very well in my own district with the partnership with Columbia Gorge Community College and their wind they've got a name for it, but wind worker certification program, because there's such a, and Representative Huffman, who was sitting next to you, of course, is a prime
opponent. I didn't wear mine yet.
Yeah, you didn't wear your little he's got a beanie you can wear, too, if you want to.
That's
that,
good.
But anyway, it's a response to what's going on in that area with the proliferation of wind power and so forth. They actually have a degree now at the community college there that certifies workers who are trained and equipped to know how to go and do maintenance and so forth on those wind generation facilities.
That's
but again, it's a response to what's happening there on the ground. The community college came up with the idea to train the workers. And, and that's where I think that marriage and that partnership works very, very well. So my impetus or my counsel would be to, yes, let's not get too down the line in terms of defining what type of occupations we're trying to train people for, because the private sector is dynamic also. We don't know what that next big thing's going to be. So we just need to be making sure that we've got well-educated, you know, folks that are able to enter any kind of workforce that may be the workforce of tomorrow.
If I might, I'd like to comment on your first comment, which was the creation of jobs. If I did say that, I didn't mean it. We did hire one person to help us run the State Energy Sector Partnership Grant, but that's about as far as our job creation goes. What government doesn't create jobs. Government can create the environment to help create jobs, and I think that's what we're doing.
And one more follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, sure.
In a relative sense, do you have any idea of how we compare to other states in regards to the equipping or the current status of our workforce right now in the area that you're concerned with? Any idea how we compare to our neighboring states?
You know, we haven't done, Representative John, we haven't really done any formal study on that. I do have some idea. I mean, I can say that Oregon leads in a lot of areas, but we are a small state.
Mm-hmm.
Texas has a lot more wind capability than we have. Michigan has been doing an incredible job of their they used to call it no worker left behind. I think with a new governor that might be changing, but the idea is all of those manufacturing jobs went away, and they need to use the skills of that workforce to try to attract a different kind of industry, and they're doing an amazing job with retooling those folks to have green jobs of all kinds, and I can't tell you what those particular ones are, but I do think that Oregon is uniquely positioned with our kind of statewide ethos that goes all the way back to Keep Oregon Green. We're known as green. We're branded as green, and I think that stands us in good stead. And is that, along with public policy such as the business energy tax credits and other things, have really attracted a number of these green new economy companies here, especially in the solar and wind fields, that we wouldn't have otherwise. And I think we're almost to some kind of tipping point where it's self-sustaining. I certainly hope so. I know that it was a deliberate policy quite a few years ago to attract the semiconductor industry here, and it was a success. And with the change in that industry, it's those same exact skills, the crystal growing and that type of semiconductor activity. It's those skills that are attracting the solar panel manufacturers here, because it's the same set of skills. So we're building on past success, and I think it's having an effect. And I'd be glad to look that up and try to figure it out. But you know, there is a study that Pew put out that compares all of the states in this, and you might look into that. I'll see if I can find that for you and get it.
That would be great, Greg. We're going to have to move on, but I would just make one more point that you've only touched on, and that's that a lot of the work that happens in this area is done regionally. Right, you partner with regional investment boards, and so there's certainly not a one-size-fits-all. What works in terms of wind power in the Hood River, you know, the Dalles area, you know, we're going to be looking at something else in the metro area or southern Oregon,
yeah, et cetera. Definitely the Oregon Workforce Investment Board can advise the governor on setting broad policy parameters or sideboards, if you will, that guide the work. And at the local level, that's where the real work takes place. There are 7 local workforce investment boards in the state that are working very hard to better the lives of individual Oregonians, and they're the ones who are carrying out this work. So you're absolutely right.
Okay. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move on to community colleges. And we have Cam Preuss, who's the commissioner, and Andrea Henderson from the Oregon Community College Association. Come and teach us.
I have a thumb drive. We're all set up for my next presentation. Now that the technology has caught up with me.
Cam, before you start, something I neglected to say before is that we're using a policy here where you don't need to run every question through both co-chairs. So for today, I'm the chair, and Tuesday it was Mark, and so
thank you.
Just to kind of simplify things.
Certainly will. Thank you for that. For the record, I'm Cam Preuss. I am the director of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, also known as the Commissioner of Community College, and my colleague.
Andrea Henderson, executive director of the Oregon Community College Association.
Mm-hmm. And we're here this morning or this afternoon to give you a brief Community College 101, if you will, and we have split the slides up, and we talked about doing a tennis match, one back and forth and back and forth, but we decided that might be even confusing for us. So I'm going to start, and then Andrea will carry on, and then I'll bat cleanup. We thought first it would be important just to, for you all, if you don't know, if you aren't familiar with the community college structure, either at the state level or locally, a picture of that is probably a helpful place to start. I'm starting in the middle of this particular slide. I am appointed by the State Board of Education. My position is responsible to that board. That board is a seven-member board that is appointed by the governor. And the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development is my primary responsibility. In that position, I administer the Community College Support Fund. That is the resource that the legislature appropriates to the community colleges. And so I am the administrative pass-through to the 17 community colleges. Through the State Board, we also approve all the programs that are provided at Oregon 17 community colleges. We audit both their student full-time equivalent numbers as well as their actual dollars. We also had some brief conversation here with Mr. White about the local workforce investment boards. We also receive the federal resources for them. Again, we are a pass-through agency for the seven local workforce investment boards. We also have responsibility for the 36 counties that the program, the Oregon Youth Conservation Corps, which is delivered in all 36 counties. And last but certainly not least, we provide through the 17 community colleges a federally funded adult literacy program. So our budget is about $600 million in the governor's recommended budget, and that's who I am and what the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development does in a brief thumbnail. Andrea?
Susan, can I just jump in? Cam, so of that $600 million, how much of that is federal dollars as opposed to state dollars?
Mr. Chair, it's about $125 million biennially that is federal. The lion's share of the resource is state general fund.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, Andrea Henderson, Oregon Community College Association. I'm going to jump in here and talk a little bit about my organization and how we fit into the structure with community colleges. The Oregon Community College Association is technically a public entity. We are a council of governments of the 17 community colleges. So each college as a college belongs to the association. We are governed by a 34-member board. It's the president of each college, and each locally elected board elects one board member to serve on the OCCA board. And I take my direction from the OCCA board. We have three lobbyists who you will see in the building representing community college issues. Each college has one vote on my board, and we work to ensure that what we are representing on behalf of community colleges is the consensus of the 17 colleges. One of the strong points of the organization is that it's very, very much the colleges determine what they would like to have represented, so it's very locally driven. Each of our colleges, as you know, is governed by a 7-member locally elected board, and the duties and responsibilities of that community college board are set in statute. We do not have a community college system with a big S. Each college is locally governed, and we have extensive ability to make decisions on the local level to ensure that what the community college is offering really fits in with the local community and what that local community needs are. So you'll see differences amongst our colleges in terms of a percentage of a type of programmatic area, the types of programs they offer, and their mission and how they construct themselves within their community. So just a few basics about community colleges. Wanted to give you a sense of community colleges in the state. There are 17 community colleges, and the blue triangles are the main campus for each college. You will see numerous satellite campuses for the community colleges as well. We are actually required by statute to be so located so that the majority of Oregonians are within commuting distance of a community college. And so a number of our colleges, particularly those in the more rural areas, will have outreach centers to allow their constituents in their local areas to access community colleges without having to drive an hour or two each way. And so I think that certainly gives you a sense of the distance. Within that, I do want to point out that not all areas of the state are within a community college district. There are a number of counties, particularly in eastern Oregon, that have not formed a community college. Each of our colleges was created locally by the local district deciding to have a community college and holding a vote to form that community college. Those areas of the state that are not within a community college district are currently served through contracts with some of our existing colleges, but the local communities have not chosen to create a community college. And part of that certainly is it's in the more remote areas of our state where there isn't the population base really to have their own college. So I put this slide up with some trepidation as it shows the when each of our colleges were founded. And I hesitate on that because actually four of our colleges all claim to be the first community college. Mm-hmm. So anytime I put this slide up, there will be three colleges that will disagree with this order. but you can certainly... Central Oregon is one that claims to have started in 1948, but they weren't recognized as a community college at that point. The community colleges' first legislative policies around community colleges were adopted in the early 60s, and you can see the creation of several community colleges from that. And again, each of those colleges were created locally by those local communities. Our most recent community college was formed in 1996 in the Klamath County. So certainly one of the largest issues facing community colleges right now is our enrollment growth. And this slide certainly shows you the enrollment growth that we've had, particularly as this recession started. It's been fairly astronomical for our colleges and has been quite a struggle for them to accommodate Oregonians who have turned to the community colleges. One piece that I do want to point out, you can see we had an earlier high point in the early 2000s and then had a fairly precipitous drop in our enrollment that has now climbed back up. At that time, the community college budgets were cut, and the colleges had fairly steep increases in tuition. And part of the drop was essentially students that couldn't afford to go. We did do a study about 5 years ago that looked at that data specifically that did show that as tuition went up, there was a very direct relationship to the enrollment dropping. We haven't seen that in this particular recession. Partly, I think the tuition has not gone up as dramatically as it did in that time period, but also we believe we have a greater number of Oregonians who don't have other choices and need to turn to the community colleges. So that enrollment number was a full-time equivalent enrollment number. Each FTE equals 510 clock hours of contact time with a student. To put that in terms of an actual headcount, last year 384,000 Oregonians attended community college. So, and I did want to mention the state appropriation. State appropriations for community colleges. This just gives you a...
Excuse me, Andrea, can I just jump in? Rep. Springer, you have a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think you answered it, but I didn't catch quite all of it. So that 384,000 number right there, so that does not... That's an equivalent, correct?
This is...
Oh, it was the headcount.
Yes.
Okay, that makes more sense then.
And just to clarify, that's unduplicated headcount, is that right? So the same person is not counted twice?
Mr. Chair, that is unduplicated headcount.
Okay.
Thank you.
Minimum number of, is there a minimum number of classes or hours to qualify, or is that person coming in for one class is up there as well as counted equally with somebody who's there close to full time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, yes, that is. If someone comes in and takes one class, okay, they will be counted in a headcount. That is every Oregonian that has used the community college in the last year. The previous slide was the FTE, which is 120,000. It's roughly 5 to 6 headcount to equal one FTE, because that gives you a better idea of looking at students, the full-time equivalent, mm-hmm, if those were all full-time mm-hmm students.
Thank you.
All right. This slide shows you just the historical funding from the legislature for community colleges. And I won't get into great detail of that, as this is not the Ways and Means Committee, but did want to point out that information. Also, with the next slide, it shows you the average state support per FTE, not headcount, but the FTE per student, and over the last several years. The current number is fairly low, which shows both the loss of funding from the state level combined with the fairly dramatic enrollment increases. This slide specifically, I'd like to focus on the blue line, which is the increases in tuition for community colleges over since 1995. And I do want to point out the steepest increase in the 2001-03 to 2003-05 biennium, where we had a fairly sharp increase that corresponds with the drop in enrollment at that time. And as we move on to community college funding, we are funded from three main revenue sources: local property taxes, the state support fund, and student tuition. We are one of the services that was impacted by Measure 5. Pre-Measure 5, approximately 50% of our funding did come from local property taxes. And we're currently, the local property taxes are about 22%. I think the real story here is that the cost of education over the last 20 years has been pushed to the students. Going from the students paid approximately 20% of the cost of education and currently are paying approximately 39% of the cost of education. And then the next slide basically has the same information but shows it to you throughout each year and how the percentages have changed. So let me now talk a little bit about what we do. Community colleges have a comprehensive mission that is in statute. And the from that comprehensive mission, there are four main areas, really, that the community colleges offer services. The largest chunk of that is lower division transfer. Currently, it's about 48% of the total FTE. Again, this is an FTE number, not a headcount number. If I were to put the headcount slide, I would show some differences as the community education, adult continuing education piece would be a much larger chunk in terms of the headcount, which accounts for the residents that come in and might take one class. The second largest chunk is our career technical education. And that is both our certificates and our AA degrees that specifically train people for jobs that are out there. We do have a fairly large portion of our services that's in developmental education, and that is a range of services. It's everything from adult literacy, for those that don't have basic reading and writing skills. It includes ESL. It includes remedial education. So for those that come in and aren't quite ready for college-level work, that would be included in the developmental education as well. Then a very small percentage of our FTE is in adult continuing education. And those are the type of programs that that aren't associated with a degree or a certificate, but is something that there's an interest in the community to offer that program. Driver's Ed would be an example of adult continuing education. We also have non-reimbursable classes. Those are ones that are not reimbursed by the state and generally are self-supporting by the local college. So they will charge enough tuition and fees to cover the cost of offering the class. And that might be a travel class, a class on cake decorating, you know, whatever that might be interest in the local community, but it's not state-supported. And so the colleges, generally on the local level, will work out a process by which they determine how much to charge for that class to pay for not only the cost of the instructor, but the overhead to offer that class.
Andrea, I have a question. Has the way this pie has been sliced up changed over the years?
Yes, and that's my next slide. this shows by over the years by program area. And I think the dramatic piece to this is looking from 2001-02 year to where we are currently. It shows a widening gap in terms of the FTE that's in lower division transfer and career technical. Career technical programs are very expensive to offer. And generally, the majority of those classes, the colleges lose money on. So they have to have enough other classes to generate revenue to cover the cost of those career technical classes. Some classes, a nursing class, can be $10,000 to $16,000 per FTE to offer that class. And it's really important for the local community to have the career technical classes because there's jobs out there for people that can enter these classes, and the community has a need for those classes. We are showing a large widening gap because, generally speaking, the lower division transfer classes are less expensive to offer.
Can we also assume that more students, you know, who would have started at a four-year school are starting at a two-year school? Is that also partly what's going on because of the economy?
Mr. Chair, we assume that that's what's going on. And certainly, as you see in our lower division, that it's had a fairly dramatic increase. There's also a piece of lower division transfer area will also include those classes that are college classes, but maybe part of a career technical program. Mm-hmm. So you may have a career technical program that has a math component to it or a science component. Those classes will count in the lower division transfer piece because we really can't differentiate. Is a person taking chemistry 101 to transfer to OUS or for a specific career technical program? So, and then the last piece I wanted to mention before turning it back over to Cam is a little bit more about our career technical programs. Just a sampling of the type of programs that our colleges offer from around the state. And some of these programs are offered at many colleges. For example, nursing. Most of our colleges have a nursing program. All of our colleges do have some sort of allied health component program as part of it because there is a need in all areas of the state. Others are very specific to their region. Our colleges work extensively with their local business community to determine what the needs are for that community and to design programs that will work with the business community to have a workforce. I think a perfect example of that is both the wind technology programs that we have at Columbia Gorge, and another great example is the viticulture programs. We now have two colleges with a viticulture center, one here in the Salem area that Chemeketa puts on, and also down in the Southern Oregon region. It's really a partnership with the local wine industry and the college to provide a viticulture program. We also have over on the coast an aquarium science program, also on the coast a maritime science program. So these programs really meet that local community business needs in those areas. Each of our career technical programs also has a local advisory committee of local businesses to ensure that what our programs are teaching meet the needs of the employers. So that's a very important component of our programs. With that, I'm going to turn it back over to the commissioner to continue talking about community colleges.
Thanks, Andrea. I'm going to talk a little bit about challenges now and move from the factoids, at least at one level, to what are we looking at in the future. You may remember that last fall, President Obama had a summit on community colleges at the White House. That was a pretty big deal for community colleges. They'd never been recognized by an administration, either positively or negatively, in this way. So we were pretty jazzed. What's important to note, though, is that along with that summit came a challenge to drastically increase not just the number of students who go to college, but the number of students who complete, who achieve their career goals. And as you can see, wants an additional 5 million graduates by 2020, and wants them across the spectrum, the certificates, associates, and students who transfer. And given our enrollment numbers, you would think that we were pretty well positioned for that. But I want to bring you back to a bill that you all heard just last week when you were joined up with the Senate Education Committee, and that was Senate Bill 253. And whether we agree that 40-40-20 is achievable or aspirational, what we know is that Oregon isn't close to achieving it. And I want to point out in this particular graph, Oregon is the middle bar. That 33% that's blue, don't believe that that is associate degrees. That is associates and some college. And Representative Harker, to your point, that could be someone who in the survey said, yes, I've taken a course at a community college. So it is valid data, but you need to peel it back a little to know what it really means. We are certainly a little above the national average in our bachelor degree awarding. We're at 28%. The national average is 27%, but again, far shy of our aspirational goal of 40. Then we've done some work. Governor Kulongowski appointed a post-secondary education commission, a quality education commission for post-secondary to look at if we were going to achieve the goals that had been set on 40-40-20, what would it take? So this shows you in pretty stark reality where is the gap between what we are currently producing and what we would need to produce. And again, the 58,000, the gap between the bachelor's degree and what we need, and the gap between associate's degrees, because it's this particular scenario says that we need about 15% of our population in the middle 40 to have associate's degree, and we need 25% to have a certificate. And that's because it's aligned to what the labor market says we need. So we're not trying to build more than than the Oregon economy says we need. But you can see our major gap is in that certificate area, and that's undergraduate certificates, that's 1 year or less than 1 year or less than 2 years. So it's a pretty good size bucket, but that's definitely where our gap is. This slide is just to remind you that the skill level that we need into the future doesn't look at all like the skill level of the past. And we're going to have more middle-skilled jobs in the state. They're going to grow faster. than high-skilled or unskilled jobs. And I have lots of backups if you want to know what the occupations are. I can bring that for you, but this is just for illustration to trying to make that point. And here's some national data that looks at the certificates awarded at all colleges, and this would be public and private colleges for individuals 18 to 44 with no college degree. So this would be certificates primarily. These are those less than two-year certificates. And Oregon is the not very clear. On my slide, it's pretty orange. And that must be because I'm an Oregon State grad. But can you all see where Oregon is on the slide? Great. And then nationally is closer to the middle. So right now, what we know is that we have work to do on the certificate side. It's just brought home by this particular slide. And then associate's degrees awarded, again, nationally, and this includes both public and private. You see the national average is 9.8%, and Oregon is at 8.5%. So,
Excuse me.
Yes. A quick question before you get too far down the road. You were mentioning middle skills. Can you define that and how you would quantify that in regards to high-skilled, middle-skilled? Just not a term I'm familiar with.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, yes, and I would. What I really want to do is make sure I get you either, I will get you the link to the middle-skilled job report because it'll do a much better job of illustrating them. But if you will, the list that Andrea went over that are the career and technical education programs, EMTs, nurses, welders, the people who are in your community, who you educate and they stay in your community, those are what we're talking about when we talk about middle-skilled jobs. They also include some on the higher end, apprenticeable trades, electrical, plumbing, construction, those kinds of jobs are also included.
That helps. Thank you.
Okay. So because we know we have work to do, in 2007, the Appropriations or Ways and Means Committee said that they wanted to have a better idea about how each of Oregon's 17 community colleges were making progress at student success. And Oregon community colleges have about 14 key performance measures that the legislature holds us to. That is not what you're seeing here. That those key performance measures include things like associate degrees, certificates, nursing, the number of GEDs, those kinds of outcome results. Well, as we did the research that was requested of the legislature, what we learned was that just reporting that outcome wasn't sufficient because if you don't do any quality control until the end product, you will have diverted sometimes as much as 100% of your product to get to that point. Excuse me, but that was definitely my old steel mill experience talking. But you have to increase the quality assurance earlier in the process. And so using that analogy, we have developed a student success framework which looks at process improvements. So how do we know how students are doing along the way, not just at the output point? So what is in front of you are areas of measurement that are important momentum points for students to make sure that if they start and they finish, that they will continue. And this is just more about that. And here on the right-hand side, the proposed student success indicators, I bring this to your attention because Andrea pointed out that the community colleges are a system with a small s. So what we did is we worked to have the 17 colleges adopt these student success indicators, not because the state told them to, but because they made sense and they would actually help improve the quality and improve the number of students who persist and complete in community colleges. So the issues on the horizon for us are really all about student success. They are about ensuring that students start. You can see we're doing a real good job at that. We have 121,000 full-time equivalents. So we have gotten the access part down
What we really need to do is make sure that we increase retention and completion, and we do that by better data collection and analysis. And we have actually called on national experts to help us analyze our data and find out where our best leverage points are. We're also having a vigorous discussion about performance funding. We currently have performance funding for our adult basic skills programs, where a larger and larger portion over the next 5 years is going to be allocated to colleges who increase the number of students who are successful in gaining literacy skill, not just entering literacy skill programs. And then, all important, how students transfer and how the students that they, the credits that they gain at the community college are good enough to articulate to a four-year university, be it public or private, in-state or out. And we've certainly done a lot of work on that, but our work is not yet complete. I'd be happy to pause there and take questions.
Great. I'd be happy to take questions. Before we do, you know, I'll say that in all of those areas on that list, we're going to be seeing some legislation involving them. So this was a, you know, a great way to sort of prepare the ground for that. So particular questions, Representative Johnson and Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regards to performance-based funding, have you had any conversations with anybody in our K-12 system? Just sorry, that was kind of a... But, you know, I'm intrigued by the idea, not in regards to income and so forth, but just that we focus on the results. You know, it's not so much just the bodies that we get into the chair. That's not the goal. It's to get them out and equipped, and I just applaud you for the model that you guys have. I think it's wonderful. So I think that was basically it. I just thought it was a really intriguing comment, and I thought it was great.
Thank you.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I just want to say thanks for community colleges. Mm-hmm. That's where I started, and I moved up university, and not only did it help me move into university, but I also took dance classes.
Whoa.
My wife and I, that was good times before we had kids. We were using all that fun stuff. I even taught Spanish at PCC for our evening course, so I have a special place in my heart for community college. Do you think you have been stymied in any way by not being part of OUS? Or maybe a better question is how has not being part of OUS helped, and how has it hurt?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lindsay, I think our community colleges are really proud of who they are and how they operate. We're currently under the State Board of Education, and historically our community colleges came out of K-12, so which is part of why we ended up where we did. We are structured like K-12. We have local property taxes, locally elected boards like K-12. And so from the college's perspective, it's been a very good fit. The colleges currently have the opportunity to work with OUS on issues through what's called the joint boards. It's a statutory direction for both the Board of Education and the Board of Higher Education to meet jointly on issues that deal with both sectors. And so that has been a process where quite a bit of work has done on both the transfer issue and some articulation issues over the years. Traditionally, because our structure is so different, traditionally, as proposals have come up in the past to put us under the Board of Higher Education, we have disagreed with that because we're locally governed and did not want to be with a state board that's a governing board. And so have had several studies amongst our colleges and conversations about governance. The result each time was that the colleges like their current governance structure. They like being where they are because we have as many interests with K-12, which we can discuss at the state board level, and with OUS, which are discussed through the joints boards. So traditionally there has been a very high degree of satisfaction with our current governance structure. There is a, as you're aware of, there is a bill over on the Senate side that creates a higher education coordinating commission. Originally, we were opposed to that bill, but have withdrawn our opposition to it, and do believe that there is some sense in that coordinating commission, as it creates a place for, at the state level, to more clearly articulate what the goals are for post-secondary education and to ensure that the funding and the accountability measures and those goals all line up. And so that's a appropriate and conversation that we hope will move us forward in our funding and our goals in the future.
Follow up.
Sure.
Thank you. Very diplomatic. There's also another bill that wants to create a local governing board. That's what I'm trying to get at. What's the advantage of having local governing board versus being under one okay. umbrella?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lindsay, our colleges are very fierce defenders of their local governance. And I think if you had just about any president or locally elected board member here at the table, what they would tell you is that their local governance is one of their greatest strengths. It ensures that the decisions for the governance of that college are made on a local level and reflect that community's needs. And they are directly accountable back to that community. If the college makes decisions that are contrary to the community's wishes, they have an immediate way to deal with that in not reelecting the board members. And that does happen. Our board elections are becoming more and more competitive. And certainly it's part of a community conversation.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And some facts that I don't think we're in here, and maybe if you can't answer them off the top of your head, maybe you can follow up, are some averages of outcomes of students. For example, how many move on from community college to four-year degree, number one. Number two, how many of those actually obtain their four-year degree? Number three, how many of these 3,000-ish students get their associate degrees? And then finally, how many drop out? And then maybe a fifth one, which you can kind of pinch hit, is what tools do you use to help progression? Instead of just growing numbers and growing enrollment, to have these students progress up the ladder.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lindsay, I don't have the figures right at my fingertips, but would be happy. Both Cam and I will work on that and get back to you with specific figures on that. I think your last question really is the critical question and really underpins the work that the community colleges and CCWD have done on student success. Traditionally, community colleges have been about getting students in the door. It's open access, anybody that wants to come in, let's get as many in as possible. The culture of community colleges is in the process of change with a greater focus on student success. We're not there yet. There's more that needs to be done to help our students transition, whether it's a student that comes in and doesn't have a GED, to transition from getting the GED to college-level courses, to students who come in for college-level courses and need to transition to OUS. We can get you some specific numbers, but that is an area that we've identified internally as a key place that we need improvement.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, if I might,
yes,
your question reminds me, particularly this last one, reminds me of an article that was just brought to my attention this morning that's called The Freedom to Fail, which talks about community colleges being so open arms to all students, is that because we tend to be that way, we are less directional and our policies tend to be less intentional for the student. And what we're finding in lots and lots of research across the country is that students don't do well if they have a myriad of choices. They really do better if you narrow the number of choices. And so as you're talking about what tools are we using to look at progression, across the state, all 17 colleges are really focusing on increasing the first term to first year
stick-to-itiveness, if you will, by really concentrating on making sure that the students are well-advised and counseled, that they know what's expected of them, and being much more intentional about, if you will, their coming to college for what purpose. And that's, as Andrea said, it's a bit of a different coat for community colleges to put on these days, but it's becoming critically important to do so.
Thank you, Tam. And again, those are issues we're going to be talking a lot about here. I will say that there's clear evidence that of those students who do transfer into the OUS system, they do as well or better than those who began in the OUS system. The challenge becomes getting more people to make that transition. And so we have to focus on how to make transfer easier. Thank you. Representative Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, you just made one of the points that I was going to. My wife's sister is the executive director of student affairs at Lane Community College, and I think she was one of the people who constantly reminding me of how well those students do when they do move on to a four-year school. Question about the local boards again. And I think that I'll just ask the question rather than guess the answer. Are there any students involved in any of the boards? The boards are open and all locally elected. Are there any students who run for the positions? Are there any slots on the boards reserved for students?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, I don't know of any colleges that have a specific locally elected slot that is reserved for students. Certainly a student could choose to run for the local board. Mm-hmm. And my current board chair this year, who is a board member from Lane Community College, is also, a returning student now that her children are grown, and is a student at Lane Community College as well. And so brings both the experience as a community member and also a current student to both the discussions at my board and her local board. Also, a number of our colleges have a spot for a non-voting member, not an official member of the board, but an opportunity for a student body president or other student rep at the table to participate in the conversations.
Okay. Follow up?
Thanks.
Under that system, as you've described, what are the avenues for students to have input into decisions of varying sorts at these different campuses?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parker, at each of our community colleges, students are very engaged in the process. Our colleges are about the students, and so I think you will see from the board members to every person that works at the college, the focus is about what the students need. And so the process might be different at each college because we have 17 locally governed colleges, sure. But I think the commonality is a commitment to students and a process that intricately involves students in what's happening. I think a very good example of that is around tuition. Our local boards are very loath to increase tuition. They don't like to. When they do...
Yet it climbs.
Yes, it does. it's for the local board, it's a decision in terms of if there's not enough money available, how are we going to limit access? And they can either limit access by not having enough seats for the students or by having it cost too much for the students. And that's really a decision that students have to be involved in. A number of times we have seen incidences where colleges have brought in a tuition increase and the students have asked for a larger tuition increase because they need the classes. It doesn't help a student to have low tuition if they can't get a seat. And so trying to find the kind of the magic mix between that is a large part of what our local boards do. And again, it's very directed at what the students need. Our colleges take very seriously that they're community colleges. It's about their students. It's about their communities.
Very good. Thanks.
Chair, I'm curious to know about your relationship with ODE, I guess specifically when it comes to putting together diploma requirements and so forth at the secondary level. Have you had a chance, or do you have an ongoing relationship there where you communicate regularly about what we're doing with these kids at that secondary level and then creating those smooth transition points to get them to you folks and so forth? So I'd talk a little bit about that relationship if you could.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, as I said, the State Board of Education is my boss, if you will, and they, I'm sort of glancing at Chair Dembrough because he had the honor of serving as the faculty advisor on the State Board of Education for 2 years, was our first faculty advisor, so he knows this firsthand. The State Board of Education meets generally a day and a half a month. The first day is usually K-12 business. Then the second half day is community colleges. The State Board of Education has very different responsibilities for K-12 than for community college. For community college, they are a coordinating board because they don't have local governance because that's at the local level. But they do have a coordinating role. They have a bit of both as K-12. So what I can tell you is that for the last uncountable number of years, we have participated in the conversation about increasing the diploma requirements and always thinking about what the next step partner, which is what community colleges, the university system, the military and apprenticeship, all of us, what is our thought about raising the bar for high school diplomas. And actually, that if we have time yet today for the National Career Readiness Certificate, the board really held off setting what some of the expectations were for the essential skills that are part and parcel of the new diploma requirements until we had established what we thought our National Career Readiness Certificate levels would be so that a student could actually use one in place of another, so that there were multiple ways to accomplish the essential skills, not just seat time in the classroom.
Okay, that helps. Good to know you guys are networking really closely.
Yes,
thank you. So we've talked about ways in which the community colleges partner with K-12. We've alluded to relationship with higher ed. I'm sorry, we are higher ed, with the university system. There's another area where the community colleges partner with state agencies, such as the Employment Division, such as Human Services for welfare-to-work kinds of programs and skill centers, things like that. I wonder if you could talk about that. I know that there's a lot of pressure on those programs under the current fiscal situation. Can you say something about them, please?
Mr. Chairman, I'll do my best. The department does participate in a statewide cabinet that's called the Workforce Policy Cabinet. And at that particular table are many of the individuals or agencies that you just named, the Employment Department, Economic Development, both the Department of Education and the Chancellor's Office of the Oregon University System, and the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And our conversation there also dovetails with your earlier presentation by Mr. White around the Oregon Workforce Investment Board. And as the board uses the research that is done by the Employment Department on where will the jobs be, and where will the high-wage jobs be, and where are they in demand? Not are they just high-wage, but are they in demand? Then our conversation is about how, if that's the demand, we are the supply. What are we going to do to increase the supply to match that demand? I can tell you that we are still after it because of some of the reasons that you mentioned. The TANF programs, the other programs that are inside the Department of Human Resources, Human Services, in order for a welfare participant to get training, there has to be a resource for them to be able to take that over to the community college to get the training. And as those budgets shrink, then the opportunity for that training also shrinks. So I guess it's a symbiotic, if you will, relationship. But we stay focused on demand occupations wherever they are, whether they're middle-skill jobs or high-skill jobs, recognizing that each of us has a place where our talent is best used. hope I'm being responsive. So I guess my whole point is that we don't operate, I mean, we operate as independent agents, but we come together to make sure that the supply and the demand, that at least in the public sector, is coordinated.
Yeah. Well, I'll just make a comment that, you know, for a lot of people who are in poverty are in poverty because they're underskilled and chronically underskilled, generationally underskilled in many areas. And I believe that the only way we can get them out of poverty and get their children out of poverty is to get their skills up. And so to have them be on welfare and not have access to, skilling up, I think is, you know, very... It's suicidal for us as a community. So, any other questions of these? Okay, then thank you very much, both of you. Yeah. I'm going to call an end to this informational session. Today's on higher education. More is coming next week. I think we're about at midterm, so I'll be sending the quiz out to the committee. And I would now like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2353, and that is a bill that essentially puts the rubber to the road on this kind of partnership between workforce, assessment, and education. So I'd like to call up for this Cam back up, and Renee, are you coming up now or what?
Cam. Yeah.
Thank you. Great. Okay, Cam, if you would reintroduce yourself for the record, please. Introduce the bill. Yeah, actually, while Cam is, while you're getting set up there, I'm going to have Anna present the bill that we're talking about. Just give a quick summary of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2353 clarifies requirements for obtaining services from the Oregon Career Readiness Certification Program, changes the name of the program to the Oregon National Career Readiness Certification Program, allows the program to serve residents of Oregon, residents of bordering states, and employees of Oregon employers. This bill declares an emergency effective on passage.
Thank you. Okay, Cam.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Cam Preuss, the Director of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. I'm going to run through, because I don't expect that all of you have boned up on what is the National Career Readiness Certificate, so I thought I would quickly acquaint you with it and sort of the why do we need it. I can see it, and it's a really pretty picture, but you can't.
I can see it in here.
You can see it?
There, something almost happened.
Okay. Oh, thank you. I don't know what I'd do without excellent help, I'll tell you. So in our current economy, we face a lot of challenges. Many of you know that this has been called the Great Recession, and they're expecting that it won't be until 2015 that we'll actually see the kind of employment numbers that we saw prior to 2008. And it's important that we make a good connection between the job seeker and the employer, and that's one of the things that the National Career Readiness Certificate is designed to do. I'm not going to read these slides to you, but essentially it's a nationally recognized and portable certificate that certifies certain sets of skills, and it can be used for both recruitment and hiring, and there are employers in the state who actually use it currently for advancement. And it's an excellent way we have found in the last 18 months of partnering with public and private. And you'll see across the bottom there, AOI, OBC, and OBA, and the manufacturers, the National Association of Manufacturers, have all endorsed this certificate as a tool to help improve hiring. You will see here the green states are the states that have registered as National Career Readiness Certificate states. And just a bit about how it got started. The company called ACT, which you may recognize as, if you have students who've taken the ACT or the SAT test, yes, that's them. They had a lot of employers after them to say, we really need the same kind of rigorous assessment in the work skills area. So they are, the premium assessment system for work-based skills. They have profiled 17,000 different jobs nationally. And when they do that profiling, they assess what level of skill is necessary for certain occupations. They have built a database, and from that database, we draw those particular levels of skill. And I think the next slide probably tells us, there you are, what the three skill, what I call skill families, are most important to employers. Now, they didn't make this up, and we didn't make this up. Actually, employers said, this is what's really important to us. Reading for information, locating information, and applied mathematics. Again, it's using those jobs that have been profiled and then really pegging what's the skill level that's necessary. And a retail sales clerk assessment of skill and what the level is for that is going to be different from a welder or from an engineer. And all of those kinds of occupations have been profiled and are part of the 17,000. The certificate comes in four different levels. It's just recently added this level 6 or platinum. But you can see here there are the bronze, silver, and gold. It also shows you if you have a bronze certificate, there are about 35% of the jobs in any economy that you have skill for. If you have a silver, it's 65%. And if you have a gold or a level 5, it's 90% of the jobs. And it also lists there for you the kinds of occupations that you would want or need that kind of that level for. And this is just what it looks like. You can't tell there. Oh, you can. Down at the very bottom in the center, there's a certificate number. That's important because there is a database that holds all the certificates. In order to have this certificate, you sit for what's called a proctored exam. So you're in a room, so Sally can't take it for Sam, and Sam can't pretend he has level 6 skills when he only has level 3 skills. And it takes about 55 minutes for each of the three different assessments. I know, I've taken it. I'm not telling you what I earned, because that's my information that I'll share with my employer. Yeah. But the whole point is that the assessment and the resulting certificate are linked to an individual.
And Cam, just to clarify that we're talking about career readiness. We're not talking about a person's skill in a particular area, right? I mean, you weren't, the exam didn't ask you how to be a commissioner, right? It was...
to Mr. Chair, that's correct. It is a level of applied skill. It isn't specific to an occupation. It's more general skills. Yes, thank you. So since Renee is here, I'm going to ask him to introduce himself, and he can talk some about the employer piece of this.
Great. Well, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Rene Leger. I'm the executive director of an organization called E3, Employers for Education Excellence. We're a statewide nonprofit that's part of the Oregon Business Council. And I have been serving as a loaned executive to this program for the past 18 months. And my primary charge is really to help employers learn about this, understand it, and get engaged. So I'm very excited about the program. We feel at a very exciting point in it. And let me just share a little bit of information for you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As Cam said, this is a credential that measures foundational skills, and those foundational skills are really what employers that we've worked with over the years are really, really interested in. We've heard stories time in and time out about how they're getting applicants typically that don't have them. So when our employers became aware of this credential and understood it more, they said, this is really something we need to get involved with. So how does an employer really get involved with this? As that slide up there says, really we ask employers to really simply prefer this in their hiring practices. It doesn't mean that they're not going to consider other things in their hiring practices. Those are some things, some examples up there, prior work experience, education, and so forth. But this is something that will be an added plus in terms of their hiring practices. And we're hopeful that over time this will have currency, common currency, and that many, many employers will get involved. Now, we're relatively and still in the early stages of this program, but it's the word is getting out, and the numbers of employers that are getting on board is really, really growing. As Cam mentioned, first we started with a phase of endorsements. The big associations, Oregon Business Council, Associated Oregon Industries, Portland Business Alliance, as well as industry groups, Utility Consortium of Oregon and Southwest Washington, Manufacturing 21, and others are endorsing this for the members, and we're trying to follow up with those endorsements and actually get people to sign on. When they sign on, what they do is they fill out what's very simple. It's a one-page format. I don't have one with me today, but I can make sure you get an example. It's called a letter of commitment, and basically the employer would simply check off a box that says, yes, our company is interested in pursuing this program. We're going to prefer it in our hiring practices. There's another box, if they choose to select it, that they can say, yes, we're interested in letting you use our name to be shared with others in public awareness about this. So we're up to about 68 right now that are using it, and these are some examples, and I just wanted to share some examples. I think sometimes people will perceive that this is only for large employers, which it's not necessarily true. It works for employers of all sizes and shapes and industries. PCC Structurals is one large employer that's been using it in a manufacturing setting. They have facilities in the Portland metro area and also in Redmond. I was just with Eileen Drake from PCC Structurals this morning presenting in Clackamas County about the program. There's a second logo up there is called Pacific Pellet. You may not have heard about them. They are a relatively small employer in Redmond, and they produce those little pellets for heat-burning stoves, and they have, I think, 6 employees, and they're planning to grow to 24, and for everyone that comes on board, they want them to have this certificate. Heinz is in Ontario, so you can see that we extend all the way to that part of the state. They're also using it in a manufacturing setting. Medicis is in Central Oregon. Northwest Natural has headquarters, of course, in Portland, but locations throughout the state. And as the numbers grow, I can't tell you all the list of the different employers, but it is really growing, and it's a variety of different types that are doing that work. Yeah, and I think just in sum here, in terms of the employer piece, really, what's the benefit for them to get involved? It's all about trying to get more qualified applicants, and this is, again, not the be-all, end-all silver bullet, but it's one other piece of information that they can use. It's validated, and it measures those foundational skills that are important. Ultimately, we hope that, and I don't have hard data right now, but we hope that it will reduce their hiring and their training costs, which is very important to all of them. And we do hope, over time, that it's incorporated into their hiring practices. And that's what's happening for some of those companies that are up there on the screen right now. And I think we're again, a very exciting crossroads. We just had a public launch for this program recently. The governor attended, as well as some other employer leaders, as well as actually a person who had earned their certificate recently and is employed now at PCC Structurals. Had over 100 people attend. Pretty good media coverage, and I've noticed that I've gotten many more calls to do presentations all across the state, so we're pretty busy getting the word out. So I think I will pause there in terms of the employer piece, and then we come back for questions if there are any around that area.
Thank you, Renee. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let's talk a little bit about the benefits to a job candidate. You probably know there are six applicants for every job that's available today in Oregon. That means you have to do something if you want to be noticed, and we believe that the NCRC is something that sets you apart from the other five or six that you're competing with. I have also known, because several individuals in my office have taken the NCRC, and it's really rewarding to see how much they are then motivated and how much more confidence they have in themselves, because they've been validated, and perhaps they didn't finish high school either, and so they're looking at this certificate as a way of communicating their own worth and their foundational skills, as Renee said. The department has been aided in our bringing this particular project up, not simply by Renee and his good work, but also by this public-private team of individuals. And this is just a listing of public and private, state and local members who have helped us. Oops, sorry, I went the wrong way. The goals of the for the National Career Readiness Certificate is, again, to grow the number of certificate holders, to create strong demand by employers, so that we can build a, and in the same time build a delivery system. So if any of you were to want to sit for the assessment and get a certificate, you could do that in the state of Oregon within a reasonable number of days. And we are also in the process of building a database that can communicate where those certificate holders are pursuing some sustainable funding. Here are the current sites where you can go for a National Career Readiness Certificate, where we have outreach available, as well as a certificate total. And we're at about 4,800. We're about to pass that 5,000 mark, which is really important for only 18 months since the department was given this assignment. So you have a bill in front of you, and I wanted to talk a little bit about why changes are needed. In the 2009 session, it was House Bill 2398 that created the CRC, the Career Readiness Certificate. And you wouldn't think that there is a big difference between a CRC and NCRC, except if you were to talk to legislative counsel or the attorney general, they would tell you there was a big difference. So we have, with the implementation committee's good guidance, we have actually moved to the National Career Readiness Certificate, and we did that because of its portability across state lines and because there are 30 other states that have it, and they are very different things. So we need now to ask you in your bill, 2353, to add that word national. There's also a clear spelling out in the bill that this is available to residents of the state of Oregon. And when we passed that bill, we thought that was perfectly adequate. But as now as we talk to employers, if you were to talk to PCC Structurals or Northwest Natural or Heinz, Heinz hires from Idaho and maybe some from Washington, mostly Idaho. PCC Structural certainly reaches across the border to hire people. And we want to be able to, as an employer based in Oregon, if they hire someone who is not a resident, we want to be able to provide the certificate for them as a way of leveling the playing field, if you will. So we would propose that we just add a couple of extra words there to expand it to businesses, employees that will be employees of a business located in Oregon. So that's what it is, and what the changes are that we would like to see.
Okay, great. Representative Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One quick, probably very easy question. On the map of current NCRC sites, you said these are places where you can go for it. What happens at this site? This is where the test is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Parker, this is the place where you can you can do all those things.
Yes.
In some of them, you can walk in the door and say, I want, and they will schedule you for when the proctor, sorry for that word, but that's what they're called, the proctor will, is doing the assessment so that you can get the certificate. There are places in the metro area where that could happen maybe in the same day, usually in the same week. There are places in eastern Oregon where it would probably be a week before they had a scheduled proctor for the assessment.
Okay.
But you could certainly, any place you go on this map, they can certainly take your information and refer you and schedule you.
Does one have to walk in, or can the bulk of this be done online or over the phone?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, right now it cannot be done over the phone because it has to be, I mean, the setup, yes,
but
certainly not the assessment.
Right.
Right,
understood. That seems appropriate, follow-up?
Yes.
Okay, good goal to strive for. Second thing is we hear the benefits to the employers and the benefits to the applicants, benefits often associated with costs, so you also mentioned seeking sustainable funding. So how are the costs currently borne, if you would?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, the costs are currently borne by the Federal Workforce Investment Act funding that the department receives.
Entirely.
Entirely. And the implementation committee is in discussion about in the out years. Right now, all costs are covered. So the individual who wants to earn the CRC or the outreach to the employer is all covered with that funding. And it's an allowable use of the resources. It's all about skilling up individuals and clearly identifying and certifying that skill. So, but we are in conversation about how to share the cost with employers and individuals in the out years. But it seemed like if we wanted to build recognition and demand for the certificate, we needed to have some pull strategy.
And is there an end in sight to that federal funding?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, no, not really. It is a forward-funded federal program that, my experience, it has existed in some form for the last 40 years.
Great. Thanks.
Great.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Couple of questions. You have four different levels of certification, correct? In this, is there one test, or do they test it depending on what level they want to shoot for? They take one test, and then you determine what level they are at. Is that the way that works?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, yes.
Okay.
There is one assessment. It's an online assessment, and so it's not always the same assessment. They scramble it up. Mm-hmm. When you finish the assessment, then you are graded, and depending on your level of completeness and correctness, then that's how they establish your.
And it's what, a few hours, a day, half a day? What's that process look like?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, each of the assessments takes 55 minutes. So the reading is 55, locating information is 55, and applied math is 55. And between us, I didn't finish the locating information.
Mm.
There are 38 questions, and I got through 34. So it's, and as you begin, the questions are fairly straightforward, and you know you can get comfortable with them, and they get harder as you progress. So question 20 was harder than question 2. Question 35 was much harder than question 20. Much more complicated.
Mm. And I hate to use the word again, but is it to be a qualified proctor? Is it someone at the college? Is there a criteria, is there a training program for that, for the people that administer the exam and then, you know, grade it, you know, do all the evaluation and so forth?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, yes, there is actually a training that you must go through in order to be a proctor. And that's a parallel process. And we are in the process of training proctors as well as getting the information out for job seekers and employers.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So this seems to be another one of those areas that's just ripe for partnership between this program and the high schools in order to help us assess the levels of our graduating seniors, and at the community college level, you know, as we're looking at students who are attending and completing programs. So can you tell us, have some of those relations already begun? And I should say, in all, you know, full candor, there are a couple of amendments that we're waiting for to be able to work this bill, and one of them is one that I've submitted, which would request the CCWD and the Department of Education to work with local districts to help create those kinds of partnerships or utilization and make that part of the annual report that the bill requires them to give to us on the progress of the NCRC. So is that happening already? Is there interest in that, Cam?
Mr. Chair, I guess the short answer is yes, but more can always be done. One of the pilots that the department undertook early on was a department with Lebanon High School, and Lebanon High School actually used the assessment for on a volunteer basis for juniors and seniors, and I forget the actual numbers, but I can tell you that I think there were like 25 certificates that were awarded. More than half of them were gold, and the rest were silvers, and they were awarded credit for that, for achieving the certificate. I can't tell you how much credit, but I do know that they were. To an earlier question by Representative Johnson, and my response in working with K-12 and through the state board, the essential skills can be, two of the essential skills can be obtained as a part of achieving the requirements for a high school diploma in the math and the reading that are two of the NCRC tests, and they are achieved at level 5 or the gold level, and they will substitute or, I guess, stand as having completed that essential skill. So that those are my two real grounded examples of K-12, but we do not have the budget, nor have we really focused on moving the NCRC within the K-12 realm, because we are concentrating on adults right now. And a way in which we are embedding it in the community college world is a silver NCRC is required for exit from some certificate programs or entry into some certificate programs, as the sheet metal apprenticeship up in Portland requires a silver certificate in order to enter that apprenticeship training. So there are some places, but it's fairly narrow band at this moment.
You know, I applaud those that are underway and would really encourage, you know, more of those. What happens if a student takes the test and scores at a bronze and is not happy with that? Can they then be directed to some kind of review to brush up on their skills? Or, you know, is there a potential educational component to this?
Mr. Chair, you're asking a question that would, if I had the time, I could back up and explain the integration of workforce services between the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development and the Employment Department, where we have really leveraged our resources across the state because we must. We are not expecting, even though this program has been funded for the last 40 years, it's not funded at the same level it was 40 years ago. So leveraging our resources and our service sites is very important. If you were an unemployed worker today and you went to a WorkSource Oregon site, the first thing we would do is say, the best way for us to help you is to know what your skills are. And instead of just taking their resume or their last job application, we actually have them sit for an assessment that's called the WIN assessment. The WIN assessment assesses the same three skill families as the NCRC: applied math, locating information, and reading for information. So the answer to your question is those are also leveled, and they are linked to the NCRC. So if you were to score bronze in math and you had a job that you had in mind and it required a silver, there are self-directed online, use it anytime you like, the middle of the night in your pajamas if you want, to build your skill in applied math that is available to you. And then you could reset and take the test, if you will, and move up. And it could be done in any of those three skill level areas.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I think we will have the opportunity to vote on this within the next week or two. I look forward to bringing it back to you. I really appreciate both of you coming forward, and Renee, your whoever it was that loaned you out, I really I thank them and thank you for the work you've been doing.
Thank you.
Okay. And with that, I'm going to end this public hearing on House Bill 2353. And I will end today's meeting of the Higher Education Subcommittee of the House Education Committee. We are adjourned.